Good afternoon. It really made my day when I got the message about this award. I went to Johns Hopkins to study public health, and the name Wade Hampton Frost was just legendary there, and neither he nor I had any idea that we would come together in this way, I think. Probably everybody in public health especially wants to make some major contribution to the field to solve some problem. And I think that the next best thing is to be honored by your colleagues and be asked to share your thoughts on a problem of great import and maybe stimulate some thinking about what the next phase of research on this problem might be. So my thanks to the awards committee and to the section for this honor, and I hope I can intrigue you with a talk entitled, What's an Epidemiologist Doing in a Place Like This? I think I'll bring this down here. So you're wondering, I think I have a disclosure slide there. What place is she talking about? I'm talking about Washington, D.C., or the United States, or any place on the globe where there's an epidemic of obesity, the effect of the epidemic of obesity. That's the area that I've been working on, and it's a problem I've been trying to solve for several years now. So these are maps of differences within the district or within the country and across the globe. That's a slide for adult females. The point being that these maps were not red, dark red, or dark brown several years ago, not when I started studying this problem, but in all of these areas, obesity is affecting a lot of the population and has become a problem of place, looking at how it's taking over in different places and learning from insights that you can gain from comparing obesity in these different places. So here's the epidemic curve, not quite rising and falling of obesity rates. We haven't really made them fall yet, but this is a curve of shifting distributions of body mass index in the U.S. population between the Haynes II survey and 2005-2006 data, where the average population just moved over by 25 pounds without much of a change in height. So the BMI levels went up. And if you use the 30 cutoff of body mass index of 30 to define obesity, you can see how with the shape of that curve changing and it's shifting, more people are crossing that line to become obese. Jeffrey Rose has made a similar illustration using the data from the INTERSALT study. These are distributions for different populations in the 32 countries where the INTERSALT study was conducted with weight and height measurements in these countries. And so figuratively, what's happened in a particular population is illustrated by what's happening by comparing distributions of populations at different stages of the obesity problem. And again, the BMI 30 cutoff to show what's actually happening when we use that cutoff, although the risk is graded. So here's yet another way of showing what place we're in. This might look familiar to some of you. It's the infamous spaghetti diagram from the United Kingdom Foresight Tackling Obesities Project. This is the map, the causal map of obesity. In the middle is the engine of that energy balance, the factors that determine energy balance. And all of the other factors and links were prepared by the Government Office of Science in a futuring project to look at obesity and think, where is this going forward, to use it for scenario building and so forth. It becomes a little bit more manageable if you overlay the different domains. And you can see then that you have the individual behavior and biology, food consumption, physical activity for energy expenditure and metabolism in the biology. And then you have the macro influence is outside, the food production and the activity environment and other societal influences at the top. So this is the place we're in. It's a complex place where it's hard to figure out where to start with something that's taken over so much of the population and that is related to something as simple as the food you take in or whether you find time to exercise. So what are epidemiologists doing to assist with navigating this complexity in a place like this? This is another picture of the Foresight map. They actually have an atlas if you're interested in this sort of thing. There's several maps, dozens of maps. And this particular version of the map is intended to show some of the non-traditional drivers or factors that you have to think about when you're working with a complex problem like this. So you can read from food supply, the food production and supply, the economy, the macroeconomic forces, education, media, also education here, technology, which is a huge driver of changes in people's eating and physical activity, the nature of work, the built environment, recreation and transport, healthcare and treatment options, and starting at the beginning, early life experiences, gestational effects, and so forth. So the question that I'm asking is, with this play on words, is epidemiology up to the task? Are we really leading in the methods of solving this epidemic? And then the other part of this question is, what am I doing here? How did I get into this mess, you could think? What am I doing in this place, and what am I doing about the obesity epidemic? So the overview of what I'm going to talk about is partly a personal and professional journey seeking to unravel this epidemic. But the reason for telling you my own story is that it shows how the context for studying this problem has changed over the time that I started studying obesity in 1984. And what's needed from epidemiology and what the science is has changed dramatically over this time. And so I'll finish with what I see as the changes in the mandate and some of the challenges going forward. So this is where I started. I was at Johns Hopkins. Wrote a review article on obesity in black women, which was a topic that I discovered because of the interest in the task force in black and minority health and looking into disparities in different areas. And so here was a nutrition problem, and my PhD is in nutrition, so that was my main subject area. And I thought, oh, this should be an obvious one to figure out. People are saying that there's more obesity in black women. And, you know, is it real? I asked these questions, is this because of measurement? Is this bias? You know, are people confusing bone with fat and so forth, all the things people would say that this isn't real? Or is this confounding by socioeconomic status? But then if it exists, does it really have health risks? And at the time, people were saying things like, oh, there's more obesity in black women, but they seem to tolerate it well. Some data coming out of South Africa and also in this country, and I remember most anecdotally a colleague sitting in the front row when I was talking about obesity and said, well, if this was a real problem, if it killed you, there wouldn't be so many heavy black women in my church. They're running the place. So you know, is this important? You know, is this really an important problem? And if so, what are the environmental and genetic reasons for black women having this high risk? The two findings of this review, one was that at the time, this was an adult onset problem. Black females were in infancy through childhood and adolescence, at least through late childhood, were not more obese than white females. So that, I thought, was a clue what's happening in adulthood. You know, you think about pregnancy, weight gain, and so forth. The other was that once ruling out that this could be attributed primarily or only to genetic factors and some of the other things that I tried to rule out, then I said there must be something obvious in the conditions of living where that's causing obesity to develop at a higher level than in other populations. So my thinking looked something like this at the time. There were these biological or genetic explanations for the race-ethnic difference. The left-hand side, the outcome was always energy balance and fatness, and so in between, you know, could you rule out that the level of excess obesity, which are ratios that they were using different standards for measuring obesity then, it was weight over height to the 1.5 for women. That takes you back a while. Now it's, everybody moved on to weight over height squared. But the ratios were like 1.9 comparing black women to white women for prevalence. Then over here in the environmental area, was it culture, socioeconomic status, or the context in which people were eating or having physical activity? Was it these behaviors, or were there certain risk factors, smoking and alcohol intake, that influence energy metabolism? Could it be that? And so I really tried through published literature to rule out these things, or to rule in something that we could approach with interventions. One of the things that jumps out and that everybody seemed to grab onto was cultural influences, because of the literature that shows that body size and body image is different in black women and in populations of color more generally, or was it dieting and the tendency to diet or the motivation to diet compared to other populations? Was it overeating, especially overeating associated with experiences of hunger and deprivation, that might lead people to into a feast and famine syndrome, feast or famine syndrome? Or did it have to do with physical activity, social status, having a car, preferring motorized transportation, preferences for types of physical activity and norms? And so you could take all these cultural explanations and think, is this really what's causing it? By the early 1990s, I had discovered, and it's funny how these thoughts, you know, unravel, because probably because I'm a black woman, I was so focused on the issue of black women initially that I didn't recognize that this was a problem of populations of color in the United States more generally. And I did a review of all the different ethnic groups, and by the time I finished the review and looked at populations, Pacific Islands, and other ethnic groups, the conclusion I came was that it was apparent that this was environmentally caused, because you could see changes over time in obesity directly linked to what was happening in the communities. And that's when I first really understood that this was a place issue. Before, when I was looking at environment, I was still really focused on individual behavior and not looking at the economic forces and the community forces. This understanding was really helped by Richard Cooper and his group, who did a study called ICSHIB. It's the International Collaborative Study on Hypertension in Blacks. And this group out of Loyola of Chicago went around and measured, I think, almost 10,000 people of African descent in Africa, rural and urban Africa, the Caribbean, the UK, and Chicago area. And what you can see is that as people move toward the UK, the US, the obesity rates, these are women, are higher in direct proportion to the environments that they're in. Same effect in men, but the obesity level is higher in women. And so this is a very good environmental explanation. It's not a migration study, but you could also see the same if you looked at migration studies. So now you're saying, okay, we have this obesogenic environment. And the ecological model was in the field at the same time. People were talking about, Anna Diaz-Rue was talking about the individualistic fallacy of attributing things to individual behavior and individual circumstances that, in fact, were group-level variables. So that's what I was working on. And then I got literally a phone call from the UK, from this man, whom I had never met, although I knew of him. He's a well-known nutrition, public health nutrition researcher named Philip James. And I knew of him because I had started my career working on salt intake. And he called and he said, we have an obesity epidemic globally, and we need someone from the U.S., and I've heard that you might be interested in such a thing. Can you come to a meeting in London next week? And you'd have to know Philip to know how he did, but he really described a public health crisis. And I found out how he got my name because obesity researchers go to obesity scientists. But obesity science was in the cell or in the metabolic pathways. And I couldn't believe that I was the only person that anybody could think of, and I'm over here studying black women, from the U.S. who actually wanted to look at the big picture of the environment. It just came together. So I didn't get to that meeting. It was a little bit too fast for me to get myself over to London, but I went to the next meeting, and this was the beginning of World Health Organization's recognition of the global epidemic of obesity. Philip James started the International Obesity Task Force, which later merged with into the International Association for the Study of Obesity, which is the umbrella organization of obesity scientific societies. And the IOTF engineered a consultation, or basically a workshop at WHO, and this was the first line kind of the report. Obesity and overweight and obesity represent a rapidly growing health threat to populations worldwide. This was news because WHO in the nutrition area had been almost entirely focused on undernutrition. It's still an issue. To get, in a world where there's still starving people, to get attention and say obesity is coming down the pike and it's important even if the hunger is still there in these countries. So they have people from all the different WHO regions. And this is the cover of the unofficial report. This is was a real public health move. The IOTF printed it themselves and sent it out to every minister of health in the world, 1997. WHO's report came out in 2000. Because they have to go through what WHO has to go through, translating into multiple languages, blah, blah, blah. So this would have been 3 years lost in beginning to send the message out because the way that we're operating, the way WHO operates, took a long time to get the message out from this consultation, even though the reports are nearly identical. So that's how I got involved in looking at the epidemic globally, come back to the United States. Surgeon General's call to action came out in 2001 and began to make the case that obesity was happening in the whole population. The second report is an Institute of Medicine report that was the first major action plan call on childhood obesity specifically. But what was my reaction when I saw the Surgeon General's report and saw all this talk about the epidemic globally? What's going to happen to black women? Because now this has become a major population problem, and the question is, where do the equity issues, do they get lost when people are trying to save themselves? Do they worry about some of the smaller groups or the groups that are left powerful? So I thought, besides my interest in the topic generally, I have to really get into this topic and make sure that the equity issues related to obesity don't get lost as people go after the big, the picture for the whole population. This is what it looked like. I found this very scary at this point because you see, these are black women, if I can make the pointer come back, these are black women starting off higher back in the 1960s. Already 25% was the body mass index over 30. And then when the epidemic started and the levels began to rise in the whole population, rising so that now the prevalence of obesity that's been reported in the past several Haines surveys is 50%, one in every two, rather than one in every four, which it was back in the 60s. And so the projections, you know, how far can this go? Black men are here. These are Mexican-American women who were not measured, were not assessed before that time period, but also then with the increasing Hispanic population, a problem in the Hispanic population as well. So I ended up in this situation where I was trying to keep up with the epidemic in the U.S., finding myself in this odd position of being a representative of issues. I mean, there are a lot of CDC people and stuff who are interested, but they needed a civilian, so to speak, to do some of this work, not someone who's working for the government. So you can see I have one of the maps. This is a map for girls. You can see how rates changed in obesity in girls globally from 1990 to 2005, 2006. It looks just like the CD maps for the U.S. So international activities in the public health version of the obesity epidemic were much more advanced coming out of London, coming out of Australia, and some other places than the effort in the U.S., and so it became a nice cross-learning experience for me to be able to bring the international picture back to the U.S. to see where we needed to go next. One of IOTF's major activities, there were more funds flowing at the time, so they actually funded a work group to make a case statement for prevention. Primary or primordial prevention of obesity, which is my particular passion, is avoiding the risk factors in the first place. So we wrote up a case statement that had an action plan and a causal web of societal influences. This working group included Bob Jeffrey at UMinnesota Epi Department, Cheryl Reitenbaugh, who's a nutritional anthropologist, Alfredo Mirabia, who is at Columbia now but was then an epidemiologist in Geneva, and Vicky Antipatis from the staff. And we came up with this causal web that some of you might have seen if you go to obesity lectures, where we began to work back from the factors that were responsible for the epidemic. We started off trying to write a narrative, trying to describe it in words. And Cheryl Reitenbaugh, a graphic artist, came up with, let's make it into a picture. The pathways are figurative, but you can make a lot of points with this particular picture. One is that some of the factors associated with globalization, which is one of the main drivers, reach almost from the global markets into the home, the lines that go, all the way over and they get into the neighborhoods. Others go through different regional, national, I don't know if I have my national filter here. No, this is the map in one picture. This is not letting me go back, so I'm going to have, there we go. Development, basically development, economic advancement, and globalization are the cause of obesity. And working through all these different sectors, you've heard about health and all policies and what Healthy People 2020 is trying to do. They have national policy levers. Some of them are more, you're more able to influence at the community or locality level. Then you get into the near environments of people, and they're all linked together. And so we began working with this. Ultimately, in other versions of this, we added undernutrition because it's the same set of factors that lead to infections and undernutrition that lead to obesity. But when we first worked this out, we were focusing on obesity. So now I have a very complicated map. Where do we start? And also ask the question, which of these things, which of these pathways might be particularly enhanced for populations who have higher levels of obesity within any given setting? So this is just an example of some of the globalization issues that we're dealing with, a lot of work on codes for marketing to children. There are two or three other activities I was involved in around that time that I'd like to highlight because they show what was happening in the field and almost where traditional epi has been marginalized in some of this work and more import given to economics and social sciences and some of other methods of doing things. So this is the egg diagram, the ecological model from a group called the Partnership to Promote Healthy Eating and Active Living, which was a public-private partnership that described causes of obesity with a psychobiologic core and then ethnic and cultural factors and then things that affect your behavior, settings where behavior takes place, influences on these settings and behaviors, and then the distal, the macro factors. So same concept drawn in a different way. The work group that I was in for this activity was asked to look at what we could learn from other attempts at social change, because by now it's obvious that we have to do sweeping social change in order to address this. So we did case studies of automotive safety, waste recycling, tobacco, breastfeeding, And then we looked at international initiatives on eating and physical activity. And Chris Economos, who's now at Tufts, led this work. Ross Brownson was involved. I don't know if others who are familiar to this group. So this was my first experience with not a case control study. We use retrospective studies. But it was a historical case analysis, which turns out to be a well-developed technique in political science. And we developed questions, and we found out who was around when these things happened and asked them what happened. And we did case studies, and then we drew out cross-cutting factors that seemed to be responsible for success or the level of success. I think we also had breastfeeding to the extent that we had been successful in those areas. And these were the key things that you need to have these social movements be effective. The only role for the science base was in proving that there was harm to come from that particular behavior, the proving that there was a reason to change the behavior. Everything else was community action, politics, or maybe, you know, showing some economic benefits. And the science for policy and environmental change and how you actually do things was not really reflected as much as the science. So we know that tobacco is associated with lung cancer. That's the science. We know obesity is bad for you. That's the science. And some political scientists, Rogan Kirsch and others, have done other case studies on situations where the government gets involved in personal behavior and including obesity. This is the Angelo model, which is called the Analysis Grid for Environments Linked to Obesity, and it comes from Australia, from my colleague Boyd Swinburne, who co-chairs the IOTF with me now. And they were working on these problems and looking for a way to deconstruct, again, a case study approach, deconstruct the causes and the levers. So they divided the environments into food or physical activity influences, micro and macro, and then four different types of environments to think about: physical, economic, policy, and social, cultural. And then use this in a workshop format with community groups to say, you know, what's available in the environment, what are the financial factors, what are the rules, what are the social cultural factors, and then try to find something that would be a lever for making change. So that was also an influence on my thinking. And then going back and looking at the disparities issue, you could look at these environments and you could say which of these environmental factors are more intensified or perhaps more salient because they affect people more even if they're at the same level in communities of color. And this is a list for environmental factors related to food and physical activity, for example. And this is what has led to this type of analysis, the current focus of the work that we're doing now, which is we're studying marketing. We're studying food marketing and how people respond to it and how you could get healthier food into black communities by changing marketing. If you had told me I'd be studying marketing instead of doing weight control classes where people always lost the weight and always gained it back, you know, I wouldn't have believed it, but it was frustrating. And you feel like you shouldn't send people out knowing now what they should be doing and they can't do it. So I started working on the why people may not be able to do it. So where are we now? This theme of the meeting is healthy communities. There's now a major focus on place, almost to the point where people don't want to allow any individual factors to come in. And, of course, it's a both and as opposed to either or. But place has taken over GIS methods, putting devices on people and seeing where they go, what they buy, what they eat, very much in the obesity literature now. There's still people studying genes and so forth, but obesity drugs have been quite a failure. So even though the genome could have taken over if they had found a magic bullet, in the absence of a magic bullet, some unlikely people are getting on to the understanding that it's really a place and a place and time issue, an environmental issue. The focus on children is for primordial prevention, but also because it's much easier to make the arguments about environmental factors with children. There's funding now for whole community efforts, and so the science has changed to a whole community science, which is much different from looking at individual factors. And they're funding collaboratives that are putting odd fellows together. The one that's most relevant here is the National Collaborative on Childhood Obesity Research, or NCOR, which includes the NIH, RWJF, CDC, and the USDA, to leverage research that is directly delivering for a social movement purpose, plus research that's more like longer latency for return. And the USDA has really jumped in a big way to this kind of research, and they have a big atlas of food deserts and so forth to show what environmental factors are. The NCOR website has created a database of surveillance systems related to obesity environments and a set of measurement tools, a registry of measurement tools, trying to keep up and create what we need to study this problem the way the problem has evolved. Where are we now in terms of prevalence? I showed you one slide. This is by income levels, by ratio, poverty income ratio. Black women in the lowest economic group near the poverty line, 55% obese. But in all income groups, it's close to 50%, or it's at least 50%. This is 48% here. And black men in the high income group may be developing the risk profile associated. It's often seen in men in different environments where if there's a gradient in obesity, the gradient is positive in men, even though it's inverse. You expect to see an inverse gradient in women. And in the children, this is the ultimate outcome of what I thought was protection of black girls when I looked at it in 1987. So the more recent epidemic has something very focused for black girls. The rates are even higher than 25%. This is 2 to 19. If you go 6 to 19, you're almost getting to 30% of the girls obese and about 20% over the 97th percentile of the standard. And how did that happen? Surely, from an epidemiologist's point of view, this must be something really obvious because, you know, we've watched the epidemic. We've watched it. You know, was it the egg salad? I mean, there's got to be something here that has changed the communities in ways that causes this this obesity to come up. And so, you know, trying to figure that out, it's probably environmental factors, but it's hard to study. I mean, it's not genetic, but it's the things that we know about already, but we have to nail it down. In Latinos, by the way, Hispanic data, it's the boys who have the highest risk, not the girls. The levels in Mexican-American boys are as high as the levels in African-American girls. There's some convergence of the global and the U.S. efforts. The IOM did a workshop in collaboration with the U.K. on policy perspectives, looked at their initiative. In the U.K., what happened after that Foresight report and the spaghetti diagram was made, how have they gone forward? And also in the area of marketing codes, the European Union funded a project to do EU-US dialogue about food marketing and food marketing standards, which met in the U.S. and in Europe over a year or so. From an evidence perspective, I think that there's a feeling, at least I'm probably biased because I've been involved in this, but there's an idea that that obesity is an exemplar, or maybe the exemplar, for studying a complex health problem that is not as focused as, say, tobacco, even though tobacco is difficult. Everything you eat and every opportunity for activity is a part of the complexity for obesity. And the whole food system, it's so fundamental. And because of that, there is concern that the paradigms we're using for evidence are too narrow and that we're going to have the perfect answer to the wrong question and will be left behind while people do guesswork using less worthy approaches than we might put there if we were involved in it. So there is some increased articulation of evidence-based public health. The problem being that so many of our good methods are based on biological types of factors. They're not based on studying environments, at least not complex environments like obesity, and they're based on therapeutic approaches that don't fit. So I think obesity is can be described as a wicked problem. This is a term from management science. It doesn't mean that it's bad. If you're not familiar, environmental science uses it a lot. So what kind of a problem is a wicked problem? Nobody really agrees what the problem is. Every time you try to change it, create a solution, it changes what you think the problem is. The solution is not true or false. It's better or worse or good enough, and we're doing a lot of good enough with obesity because some of the rates may still be, there may be some plateaus, but rates of obesity in subpopulations may still be increasing, even if they're averaging out in the population as a whole. There are many stakeholders who have different ideas about what the problem is, and you can see that debated in the literature, especially when you put the commercial sector in, who will say the problem is personal responsibility. Some people say, well, it's parents, it's not the schools, and so forth. The ultimate outcome of the problem is not really determined by evidence, although it should be evidence-informed. It's determined by the stakeholders and the political dialogue and the resource availability and a lot of judgments. No best practices because everything has to be contextually specific. So what works in one community with menu labeling or something like that works someplace, something different when you have a different city council and so forth. So everything is every problem is unique and solutions must be tailored. And I think that's a good characterization of obesity right now. And it offers tremendous challenges. It should just really compel people to try to sort it out and embrace the complexity. The Institute of Medicine was asked to create kind of a proactive initiative or an offensive on this evidence issue, because the situation was that people were saying nothing works in obesity prevention. All the randomized controlled trials have failed. They were often trials with manipulating one variable, you know, doing something in a school but leaving the family and everything else in the community the same. Trials are not working. Nothing works. Throw up your hands. So people couldn't get money, couldn't get traction to do anything. And there was a sense that other types of evidence were really relevant. And we had done in the IOTF some work on this before. Like, what type of evidence would you really need to address a complex solution? And I won't go into the details of the report, but just want to focus on the systems perspective. The algorithm we developed, which is in this box, is called LEAD, locate evidence, evaluate evidence, assemble it, and inform decision. So it's not a decision-making algorithm, but it's taking the steps in evidence gathering and then looking at them differently depending on what the question is. So the evidence should be fit for purpose. The purpose is defined by the question. If your question is, should I do something or how big is the problem, yes, you want a prevalence study. But if the question is, what intervention should I choose or how would I deliver this intervention, you want a totally different type of evidence. I think Pettigrew calls it horses for courses, you know, same point. So we took some tenets from evidence-based public health, adapted them. But what we added here was the critical need for a systems perspective. Hard as it is to sort things out, when you leave them in their natural complexity, we felt that this was really essential. Systems thinking, not necessarily only doing systems models, but adding systems thinking to the way we're approaching evidence for obesity. So this report is available. We go into details about admissible evidence, parallel evidence like looking at tobacco or breastfeeding or waste recycling, quasi-experimental studies. We have a primer on quasi-experimental studies, and I'll be giving a talk about this report actually tomorrow. But keeping that systems perspective and using it for both finding evidence and generating evidence, because there are more opportunities to generate evidence in this area than there's actually evidence there now. The evidence that's there answers wonderful questions and probably has made many promotions and tenure, but it is not informing policymakers. People are doing research on questions that relate to ideas that are not linked to where the problem has gone, and that's why I feel, you know, like, are we keeping up with where the problem is instead of developing solutions in case someone should ever need them? I'm not cynical, but I'm really focused on, we need to solve some problems, not just keep doing research. So where am I now? I'm actually involved in several systems projects, some of which are linked. I didn't put on this slide the Network for Inequality, Complexity, and Health, which is funded by the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research and is headed by George Kaplan and Ana Diaz-Rue, and it's looking at all kinds of disparities. But this is a chance to bring kind of content people together with systems modelers and find out what tools there are to do the thinking, either qualitatively or quantitatively, to look at this problem in its full complexity. And then there's a new center funded at Hopkins, being called the Johns Hopkins Global Center for Childhood Obesity. A tagline would probably be something like where system science meets public health. And that is funded partly by OBSSR, but by the Child Health Institute, together with OBSSR. So there's a big emphasis on systems research coming out of NIH through the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research. I'm also working on solving the issues in African Americans through an organization that I found myself forming in 2002 because there needed to be more people having a conversation about what to do about obesity in the black community. And now we have 70 people in this network, many of them here at APHA, and we're trying to take a community perspective on the issue to make sure that the solutions we come up with will fit the community. This is just reflects the Hopkins project that I'm involved in. Where am I? Probably will be in China at some point because you can just look at the form of this graph. Obesity rates in China are skyrocketing. And China is the focus of one of the projects in this new Johns Hopkins Global Center under Yufa Wang, because it is living the epidemic. This is our second chance. We let the epidemic go by in the U.S. We weren't studying it. Well, in China, it's happening now, and they're putting up Kentucky Fried Chickens, you know, new ones every day, and the bicycle traffic. This was 20 years ago, and this is what it looks like today. With the car population going up. And so I will be trying to learn from places where they haven't gotten yet where we are and see what can be extracted in terms of insights to bring back to the U.S. and also to help solve the problem in China. For the African American Collaborative Obesity Research Network, we're trying an approach that is type of a mixed methods case study, historical in bringing in historical factors affecting African Americans, concurrent in looking at what's in the community, and putting that together with a lot of qualitative research. I don't think there's any such thing as qualitative epidemiology, but I know when I spoke at the Hopkins 80th anniversary, I said, if I had one thing to say, I would say find somebody who does qualitative research, because we can't do our work unless we know what to assess, what to measure, what patterns are out there. And some of those you can only learn by talking to people or listening to people even better. So this is our community model for helping community members to ask questions about their environment. It's hard to get people don't think of themselves as, I'm in a disparity. You have to point people to things, and they don't even see that the systematic things in their environments are actually causing them to navigate towards an obesogenic way of living. So the last three slides it's a summary, but it's also what I think of the mandates. The person-environment interaction, so that we come back from the overcorrection of only looking at environmental factors, because it's what people do in these environments that's important. Finding the pathways that are most important, generally and for disparities. And then surveillance and monitoring, we have a whole new set of things to measure. WHO is scrambling to figure out how do you measure if food marketing is changing? How do you monitor what food companies are doing? So we have a lot of new variables. We need instruments to measure these things. We don't have good surveys of what's happening in environments in schools. We have one at CDC. We have some neighborhood indices and report cards, but this is a wonderful area for new methods development. Find the variables that are important and learn how to measure them, partnering with other disciplines probably. Another is assessing impact of policy interventions in particular and linking the impacts to the intervention. So we have policies changing, but we don't necessarily know if they're having an impact or vice versa. Evidence paradigms, gathering and generating evidence that can inform policy and getting that out in real time without being hasty. Modeling potential solutions, their methods, cost effectiveness, and health impact assessment are the two that are being used most. The cost effectiveness modeling in different ways and trying to put strings of causal change together and look at how many calories you could save and would it be worth your investment if you followed that pathway. Oh, the three and two are backwards. The whole community initiatives that have to be assessed, where are the methods? All these community studies or the observational study that's being done, the healthy community study of looking at what's happening, where are the methods? Are people learning this in school? Do we really have any idea of how you measure a whole community index? It shouldn't be a free-for-all, but I'm afraid that we haven't caught up with this level of methods development. Systems thinking, and then finally, I mentioned this indirectly before, it's a crowded field. All of a sudden, with understanding that the obesity epidemic is being caused by other sectors, a lot of people are obesity experts who are not health people, which is good, but I don't want us to be left behind. So we have competition from people who in some cases have stronger methods for studying social science than we do, or for analyzing policy than we do. What do we know about policy analysis? And have we read policy books to see how to do that and how to bring that in or partner with people doing that? So those are the thoughts I wanted to provide in honor of Wade Hampton Frost, and I hope I've stimulated your thinking and maybe encouraged you to move a little bit out of your comfort zone to get where we need to be. Thank you.